Inside the Cross Podcast.
Welcome back to another edition of the Inside Lacrosse Division I Men's Podcast with D-Fly and Dixie, featuring Mark Dixon. And we have special guests today. Matt Kinnear, Inside Lacrosse Editor-in-Chief, is here to... he was at the Delaware game, and we'll get into that in a second. Welcome to another week of this podcast. Dixie, you ready to do this again?
I am. And I like the Dixie D-Fly name, but I want people to know that this is basically takeaways. So my takeaway column, meaning what happened the weekend prior to, used to be sitting down and banging out an article, writing an article. Now we're articulating via podcast. So, I threw out a Twitter. The Pitt at Maryland got back to me. They want to, asking about topics. And the Pitt at Maryland wants to talk about Navy Maryland. Well, Navy plays Hopkins at the time we're recording this. They still have Hopkins to play. And then another gentleman, Scott Hensley, wanted to talk about Ricky Solon and Navy. This is a retrospective look for the most part. Quint and Terry have the prospective look ahead podcast on Fridays. So thank you to the Pitt. Thanks, Scott Hensley. We probably won't hit those two topics today, but really this is the takeaways, what we learned from the weekend, what we saw from the weekend, highlight individual performances, trends, that kind of thing. And it's just really exciting to be back and looking forward to the podcast all season long.
Yeah, and if you have questions you're looking for Mark to answer, you can hit him up on Twitter at Dixon Lacrosse, or you can reach out to me at @D_Fly to give us your questions, and we'll try to address them on the podcast. So let's get right into it. It was the first weekend of the season. There was a game on Thursday. Vermont got by Furman in overtime, and then a good schedule of games on Saturday and a couple on Sunday. One of the more interesting games was the more exciting games for an early season game with lots of goals was the Bucknell Delaware game. And Matt Kinnear, you were there in Newark for that one.
Yeah, it was not what I expected from a season opening game. It was not what I expected from Delaware in terms of their offense. Just overall, not kind of, if you would have wrote up a script for this game, it wasn't what you would have expected at all, what actually happened. I was really impressed with both teams for different reasons. Delaware, I thought their offense was as good as I've seen it, probably in 5 or 6 years, to be quite honest. Bucknell, they started off a little sluggish early, but I'm just really impressed with the character they had coming back. Goalie Christian Klipstein was actually pulled for a brief spell in this game. He came back and played the second half of the game much better than he did when he first came out. So overall, just a really exciting game. 27 goals scored, 14-13. I totally did not expect that. I thought it was going to be a 7-6, 8-7 game. But really, kind of these early season games, you're seeing offense take over a little bit. I thought both teams, the defense, just didn't really look in sync quite yet. A lot of one-on-one stuff that, when you look at Will Sands for Bucknell, you look at Andrew Romagnoli for Delaware, the offensive players were able to get that matchup of just going one-on-one. The defense wasn't quite in sync and playing as a unit yet, and that's why you saw a high-scoring game.
Yeah, Will Sands for Bucknell had 7 points along with Sean O'Brien. Did it differently. Sean O'Brien was 6 goals, 1 assist. Sands was more of a feeder, 2 goals, 5 assists. So some big offense coming in the first game of the season. But there were some other storylines there, Matt. And, it's Coach Bob Schillinglaw stepping down, announced earlier last week prior to the game that he was going to, after 39 seasons, he will be hanging it up at the conclusion of the 2017 season, and you had a chance to sit down and talk to him a little bit, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Coach Schillinglaw is someone I've gotten to know pretty well over the years. Me living not too far from Newark, Delaware, and having family up there as well. I've been on campus quite a bit up there and seen them, in the fall and in the spring and many occasions. So I got to talk with Coach Schillinglaw a little bit after the game. He's really focused on not making this about him. It's funny, after the game, there was a handful of alums, friends of the program who were talking to Coach Schillinglaw before I got a chance to talk to him. And they were laughing and joking, and I heard one of them say, "This is the year of Shills." And I thought that was great. I asked him about it, and he said, it's not the year of Shills. Every game, every year is about the players. It should never be about the coach. He wanted to deflect any attention toward him, but I think it's going to be really difficult to do that. I know at least one opposing team is already planning – kind of an event for Schilling Law when he comes to their stadium this year. So I think it really is going to be the year of Shills, you know, even if he doesn't want it to be, even if he wants the attention on his players. And it's well-deserved. 39 years is an accomplishment for anybody. 39 years Division I lacrosse is just really remarkable. And, you know, even though Delaware hasn't had a ton of success the past few years, you know, they've consistently been a program that, you know, if you look at the Headstrong, the Mustache Madness, they're always one of the teams raising some of the most money. You know, they're always kind of active in the community. They've done a lot of the right things. Coach Schilling Law has done a lot of the right things. So I'm hoping that he gets the attention he deserves. I'm hoping he gets the farewell tour like the MLB players when, you know, Jeter's going in opposing stadiums getting the gifts. I know he doesn't quite want that, but, you know, I hope he comes around because he really deserves it.
He's more like the Kobe Bryant, you know, on the, what is Towson going to give him when he, you know, what is Hofstra going to give him, the conference opponents? You know, you look back at his career, the mid-'80s, they make the NCAA tournament, led by a player by the name of Randy Powers, who at the time, he's a New York guy. And I apologize to Powers. He was either upstate or Long Island. And at the time, Delaware wasn't getting those kind of players. And he is a guy that led them to the NCAAs. John Grant Jr. Had his career at Delaware between the hedges and made a couple of NCAA tournament appearances. You know, Alex Smith and the 07 team going to the championship weekend. So, you know, it's been 39 years. It's a long time. And it's amazing. I think that it was mentioned that Schilling Law, 64 years old, 39. So he's 25 when he took that program over. So he's a, you know, at 25, I was still trying to figure out, like, what I want to do for a living. And he's, you know, leading a Division I lacrosse program. So, it's not the, you know, he doesn't think it's the year of Shills, but he's going to be getting a lot of tributes. But he, you know, obviously he cares about the kids and the type of product that he puts on the field and the type of year that they're going to have. And based off of this result, they're going to be a very competitive lacrosse team in 2017.
One more thing with Schilling Law is, you know, obviously we talk about his team, but he's one of those guys who's kind of been part of this growth of the sport in many ways. He's, you know, served on rules committees. I believe in 86 was the first NCAA Final Four kind of event at Delaware. Yeah. He came in last minute to host that event, you know, when some other stuff fell through. So he's really kind of put the sport of lacrosse before himself in many ways. So it's not surprising that he's putting the sport ahead of his own kind of tributes heading into this final year.
So just a follow-up question about the team, Matt. So in our face-off yearbook, we have them ranked 51, which is kind of low for, say, a quality team. After watching them play and seeing what their offense is capable of, do you expect, are you more hopeful for their season?
I definitely think so. You know, I'd certainly, if we had to re-rank them, they'd be, you know, I'd say somewhere in the low 40s. But I think what you're seeing is in that CAA tier, they're on that tier now where they can compete for a CAA tournament spot. You know, I think that obviously the top tier of Towson and Fairfield is going to be tough to catch. Hofstra right up there kind of with those two. And but I think Delaware really has a chance to get that fourth spot. You know, I think they can kind of take a team like UMass and beat them. And, you know, I would not be surprised if they get to the CAA tournament and, you know, you're playing for a little bit extra when you know it's your legendary head coach's last season. So there's a lot to be excited about. The offense was really good. And the thing that really, you know, I appreciated about their offense this year was they had 9 turnovers, which by Delaware standards is a very good turnover number. Last year they averaged, I think, like 14.3 turnovers a game. So if they're able to play kind of as fast as they do, fast and loose, but protecting the ball and not giving it away. Obviously they had some mistakes down at the end of the game that they're going to need to clean up if they're going to want to, you know, kind of improve on last season's record. But, you know, that was a hopeful start, only having 9 turnovers against a Bucknell team that is a really good defensive team, has a lot of playmakers on defense.
And I think when you look at Delaware's schedule, it's going to their path to the NCAA is probably through the CAA. Navy is a notable on their schedule, Villanova. And then other than that, Rutgers is on their schedule. But, you know, so much of that out-of-conference depends on how those teams play through the course of a season. So a win could be a quality win. A loss could be something that's not a bad loss. But it's really they're going to hang their hat on the Colonial Athletic Association qualifying for that postseason tournament and hopefully putting themselves in a position to grab the automatic qualifier. And if not getting the AQ, then having that resume strong enough to get an at-large perhaps.
Moving on, Dix. Another big game. Maybe the only real upset of the weekend, if you want to call it that. But Air Force goes down to Durham and gets the Blue Devils again for the second year in a row. A bit of a surprise.
And I think the surprise is that Air Force went into Duke a second consecutive year and knocked off the Blue Devils. If you recall, a year ago, Air Force won a game in overtime that was a little bit controversial due to an over and back and then a quick restart where two Duke players are lying on the ground. I believe the officials got it right in the quick restart. But you know, there was some controversy surrounding it. No controversy this time. And I think the things to be impressed with Air Force, one, with the game tied at 8 apiece, they were down 8-6, and they went on a 5-goal run to turn an 8-6 deficit into an 11-8 advantage, and then Justin Gutterding tried to get Duke back in the game, two goals 40 seconds apart, the last coming with 7:06 left in the game, but Air Force was able to get that last 7 minutes to get the win. A couple things, too. There's two things that we've gotten used to in lacrosse. That is February upsets, and one of those February upsets, if not more, being Duke. So I think this says less about Duke and more about the job that Eric Saramet is doing in Colorado Springs with this Air Force team. Nick Ruby, 4 goals. Chris Walsh had a big day with 2 goals. And this is after graduating Christopher Allen. You know, he graduates 31 goals. A couple years prior to that, Keith Dreyer, Tommy McKee, Mike Crampton, you know, players that really put Air Force on the map and helped build that program with Eric Saramet are gone. But the foundation that these guys have laid, so impressive that they can come back. Southern Conference champions a year ago. They go to Notre Dame, losing the first round of the NCAA tournament, but to come and kick off their 2017 campaign with a visit to Duke, with a big win like this, having a 5-goal run, that I think that says a tremendous amount about Eric Saramet and Air Force lacrosse.
Duke had graduated a lot of goals, as we talked about last time, and playing a lot of young guys. And this is a very telling quote Donowski said after the game, that there were some good things and some bad things on offense. Quigley scored his first college goal, and Sean Cerrone his first Duke goal. But this is the important part. But there were some really uneven spots, and there is no senior or junior out there to show them the way. It's going to make for an interesting year. And it's true. I mean, as we talked about last time, they graduate some big name guys. And outside of, you know, Justin Gutterding, they're getting goals from freshman Joey Manown and Kevin Quigley and Sean Cerrone. So it's a lot of new faces in Durham.
No question. And when you look at this Duke program, 2 first-round NCAA exits in 2015, losing to Ohio State at home. And then last year, 2016, losing to Loyola on the road. And these are the two successive seasons after the national title in 2014. So obviously there's a lot of youth in Durham this year, but what better coach to get that youth than a guy like John Donowski? His demeanor, his approach, not only to the game but to life, but it's well documented that he might be the best coach in terms of fundamentals for his players. No elaborate schemes, no intricate defenses, no confusing offenses. Most of their practice time is spent on fundamentals, learning the game of lacrosse, executing the game of lacrosse. So I think we've seen year in and year out, the Duke team that you see in February is not the Duke team that you see in May. Obviously, the last 2 years, they haven't really gotten those results. But it'll be interesting to see the maturation and the development of this team. I had them ranked maybe 7th or 8th in the preseason. So I'm thinking maybe I had them a little bit high in the preseason, but it remains to be seen how this team will progress over the course of 2017.
And he's known for that, as you mentioned. He brings the team along, sometimes slower than other coaches do, but they usually are ready and playing their best lacrosse late in the season.
I think the interesting thing about John Donowski, we see it so much in college sports. You know, I'm not just talking about college lacrosse. A team has a bad stretch or a bad start or this or that. We've redefined our mission, or we've circled the wagons. That's not in John Donowski's vernacular. It's one game at a time. Hey, you know, we lost this game. We got to come out and play better. We got to practice better. We got to play better. You know, there's no reinventing the wheel. There's no re-identifying their purpose. They know what they're there for. They know why they play the game. They know what results they want to get, and it's nothing fancy with his approach.
Yeah, so moving on, a team that had a really good weekend were the Vermont Catamounts. New coach Chris Fifes. They go down south, find some good weather, and they win two games in overtime with final scores of 13-12. They kicked off the season on Thursday, beating Furman, and then went over to Atlanta and played Mercer on Sunday, and again picked up two good wins. What's that say about a young coach and a team that's got a lot of experience, though?
This is a program that is on the upswing, and when you look at what Ryan Curtis was able to do last season, it was funny. I called the America East Championship on ESPNU with Chris Cotter, and all week we were like, okay, well, we've got our boards ready for Stony Brook and Albany, because those are the two teams that are going to be in the championship. Albany was hosting, and Hartford and Vermont up and beat both of them and gave us an incredible America East Championship. The score was either 16-15, 17-16. I can't remember. It was a one-goal game. So Fifes gets the job, and he's on a little bit of a win streak. You know, North Carolina's win streak last year as the defensive coach, and now he goes to Vermont, and he wins his first two games. I think what it says about this team is they're going to be competitive. Wins over Furman and the win over Mercer. So obviously, you know, Furman and Mercer are not on the tip of your tongue in terms of the upper echelon just yet of college lacrosse, two programs that are building, members of the Southern Conference. But to go down south and have that quick turnaround, that quick road trip, and get two wins, the Furman game was a comeback win, Mercer was a comeback win, I think that says a lot about the makeup of this team. They've got some individual talent. McKee on attack is very, very good. They've got some other kids that can put the ball in the back of the net. This is a team, it's not, you know, Fifes is a defensive coach. They're going to win a lot of games. Cam Milligan, that's who I was trying to think of. I mean, he's terrific. And Dawes Milchling had a real nice freshman season. He's off to a good start as a sophomore. It's just one of those things where they're going to win games 13-12, 14-13. That's where Vermont is right now. They're a very good offensive team. Defensively, they need to catch up a little bit. But what a way to start the season. The margin between victory and losses is so very slim. They could easily be 0-2, but they're 2-0 on the Southern road trip, and that's a great start to the season and Chris Fife's coaching career at Vermont.
Interesting schedule note for Vermont. They open up with two games. They don't play again until February 18th, so they have a two-week break until they play their next game when they host Holy Cross. They can look at home against Holy Cross, at Providence, at Dartmouth. They're off good chance they start the season. We'll get a few more wins before getting into before March, basically. So good to see a young coach getting his team and his head coaching career off to a fast start. Speaking of fast starts and new coaches, Cleveland State, Division I's newest team, played their first game ever on Saturday night in Cleveland inside their dome bubble facility. Terry Foy was out there. Patrick McEwen was out there. Terry's a native of Cleveland. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, for lacrosse in upstate or northeastern Ohio, this is a huge, huge event, just besides another Division I team playing their first game. And they had a good showing. You know, Dylan Sharon's team got down 6-1, but made a game of it, and a decent Michigan team took them 13-8 was the final score. What are your thoughts on this?
First of all, to take a program to a non-traditional area is where the game needs to go. And I think if you look at the landscape of college lacrosse, you know, obviously we want the game to creep into the Pac-12. We want more expansion in the Big Ten. But to have a Cleveland State make a commitment to the sport, I think it's pretty special. And when you look at Dylan Sheridan, a young man who spent time at Denver, spent time at Princeton, son-in-law, not only assistant coach to Bill Tierney, but son-in-law to Bill Tierney. Yeah. He coached the Faceoff Men at Denver a couple years ago. And I've had a chance to talk to Coach Sheridan on a couple of occasions. He's a guy who cares about the game. He's a detailed-oriented guy. I think it says a lot about lacrosse. And it's fun to see. And they came out, had a good crowd inside, just a lot of excitement, and just a you know, not the start they wanted. Obviously, they'd rather be 1-0, sure, as opposed to 0-1. But they played Michigan. Michigan's hungry this year. Michigan wants to take that step forward. I think it's also important to note that the Cleveland State Athletic Director is John Perry. And this is a gentleman who we talked about Bob Schillinglaw in the 86 championship weekend, the first ever Final Four at Newark, Delaware. John Perry was also a cog in getting the Final Four up and running.
Very much so.
The automatic qualifier, John Perry was a huge proponent of that. Butler, he oversaw that Butler program.
Sure.
Darcy Sweet and some of those great players that had the Bulldogs in the NCAA tournament a couple of times before the school pulled the plug on men's lacrosse. And now he's the athletic director of Cleveland State. So I think it's, you know, you're seeing someone supporting a program that has supported the game before. And how neat would it be to have other pioneers and forward thinkers like a John Perry end up at, we're seeing at the University of Florida, the women's program with Foley, the athletic director?
Jeremy Foley.
Who played lacrosse at Hobart. You see the ascension of the Florida women's program to a top five, top four program perennially now, or annually, I should say. We'd love to see that happen more on the men's side. So a lot of positives for Cleveland State moving forward, despite the loss, and a lot of things to look forward to from the Vikings.
Yeah, I mean, they acquitted themselves well in their first game, and they're taking on all comers. Their next game is at Duke, and they go to Denver for a game. And while they're out there, they'll play back-to-back. They'll play Denver one day and Air Force the next. They play at Ohio State, which is great for their in-state recruiting. At Penn State, at Virginia. So they have a challenging schedule that they're taking on all comers.
No question. And I think it's one of those things where you look at the schedule that they're playing and you want to be in the upper tier. Now, is this schedule maybe a little too ambitious? Perhaps. But you've got Baldwin Wallace included in there. You got John Carroll included in there. Walsh, Sacred Heart could be a winnable game. Detroit Mercy, which made an NCAA tournament appearance a few years ago. So you've got some games interspersed, some breathers, if you will. And that's no disrespect to those programs by any stretch of the imagination. But when you're looking at that gauntlet of at Duke, at Denver, I mean, it's at Ohio State, at Penn State, like you said, at Fairfield, at Hofstra, at Virginia. Look, it's kids, that's how you get recruits, you know. If you're Cleveland State and you're trying to build something, yeah, you're going to take your lumps. You're going to get your teeth kicked in probably more times than you're not. But if you can go to a recruit who's thinking about maybe a D3 program or one of those, you know, D1 programs where they might fit in, and you can say, look, we're going to play all these teams, kids are going to want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
They are going to want to be a part of that, and so that's why you play the ambitious schedule.
And you got to give some credit to the opposing coaches who are willing to take a game against Cleveland State in their first year. And maybe that's a part of their thought process is that it is good for the sport and that it is good for Cleveland State. And while it might not be, we'll see how they perform on the field, but, you know, usually first-year programs don't obviously have a lot of talent. And for some of these, you know, top 10, top 20 type teams to take them on, it you know, they might be better off just having an inter-squad practice or a schedule. So it's I give some credit to the opposing coaches for saying, yeah, we'll play you. Come on down.
And one of those coaches are going to coach the team that's going to lose to Cleveland State. I'm not saying it's going to be this year. It might not be next year. But one of these days, Cleveland State's going to get that signature win.
Yeah, that's going to be cool when that happens.
That big first win under their belt. And like you said, yeah, of course we'll play Cleveland State. We'll host you, and it's good for the game, and it's good for exposure. But, you know, none of those coaches want to be the first victim of Dylan Sheridan and his ball club. But it will happen eventually.
On the other hand, it was a big season for John Paul and the Michigan Wolverines. Good for them to get a good win to start in a crazy environment in Cleveland, I'm sure. And they got to get some wins early in the season before they get in the Big Ten play. They have Lafayette, at Detroit, at Bellarmine, all winnable games, I think, for them before they meet Notre Dame on the road on the 26th of February. So they're a team that is also saying, like, hey, let's get to our Big Ten tournament. Let's get a slot in that, and who knows what can happen once we're in the tournament.
I agree with you to a point. I thought Michigan got off to a good start last year. They scored a really nice win over Colgate. The Raiders didn't have the season I think that they wanted to when it was all said and done, but at the time that was a nice big win for Michigan. That was a team last year that was really beset by a lot of injuries. And this year, if they can stay healthy, I mean, they've got some nice players. You know, Mikey Schlosser at the midfield, he's better known for his mullet and the Jeff Shannon tweet that he wasn't previewing the 1976 season, but rather the 1976 season that he jumped in his Camaro and sped away. I thought that, or maybe it was Trans Am, I don't know. Jeff Shannon, tip of the cap to you, tweet of the week for me, in my opinion. But you got a guy like Ian King, who's a tremendous playmaker. You've got Schlosser, as I mentioned. This is a team that can play. They can play lacrosse, and you know they're going to need to get consistent goaltending. Tommy Height made 14 saves against Cleveland State. Gerald Logan, their starter for the last few seasons, is a fifth year at Johns Hopkins. So getting good goaltending, winning faceoffs is going to be absolutely critical. And Mike McDonald won 15 out of 22 against Cleveland State, so that's a good start. But you're right. This is a year where I think Michigan. I think the first goal, if I'm Michigan, is obviously win. You know, you take one game at a time, but making that Big Ten tournament, being one of the four teams left standing out of that now 16-team conference to make it to the Big Ten tournament, to give them an opportunity to advance to the Big Ten championship game, and then ultimately maybe grab the automatic qualifier. Again, a lot like we were talking about earlier with Delaware, the regular season schedule is good, but it's going to be conference play that's going to propel them into a possible at-large bid if the automatic qualifier doesn't work out.
Yeah, another team you want to talk about, just moving down into the other Big Ten team that opened up their season, is Penn State. Played Robert Morse, got the W, but it wasn't that easy. I mean, it was Robert Morse gave him a good game. They win 15-11, and they get a lot of scoring from some of the usuals. Grant Ament, 5 assists. O'Keefe, 7 goals. And your guy, Nick Aponte, you love that kid, right?
Aponte, I think Aponte's are. I thought he was the best offensive player in the Big Ten last year, and he is. I love watching him.
So, what's your main takeaway from this game?
First thing is, Robert Morris is one tough guy. So he plays hard every single time. Bobby Moe, just kidding. This is always a challenging game for Penn State. Robert Morris always brings their A game for every competition, let alone against Penn State. But what a weekend for the Nittany Lions. Chris Hogan wins a Super Bowl.
Yeah, on the front page of their website.
Front page of their website, and that was just a great narrative for the last couple of weeks, the lacrosse angle. I know on Fox, the pregame show, had a feature of Hogan and some of his lacrosse background. And then they get the win this weekend. So, you know, Mac O'Keefe, 7 goals. I know he's somebody that we've kept our eye on as a rising freshman, somebody who can do a lot of damage. And, I mean, 7 goals on 12 shots in your debut is pretty special. And I guess the big question was, who's going to take T.J. Sanders' spot as the primary finisher on that ball club? Well, I think the answer is Mac O'Keefe, you know, and obviously the trick will be consistently to be this. To do this, but what you have to like is O'Keefe, 7 goals, Grant Ament, 5 assists. I thought he was very good as a freshman last year. Showed a lot of signs of what, you know, to be a future star in Happy Valley. Also showed some immature tendencies. We saw him pulled late in the game against Johns Hopkins. We saw him take some penalties for taunting opponents in the Big Ten season. I think he's grown up quite a bit. Then you've got Aponte, who I think is tremendous. In the midfield, Mike Sutton, 4 goals against Robert Morris. Dan Craig is a guy who's always dangerous. And you got to look at the faceoffs. They've got a freshman that played great, Gerard Arseri, 21 out of 30 at the faceoff dot. Last year, Penn State had a ton of injuries at the faceoff, and to have Arseri come in and do such a great job. I think the other important thing to remember is, you know, this team is one year further removed from the Connor Darcy tragedy. I know that weighed heavily on their minds last year. So this is a dangerous team. I think Penn State and Virginia going into the preseason were my two teams picked to be most improved. And what I mean by that is being serious contenders for conference championships and also serious contenders to gain spots in the NCAA tournament and ultimately finish the year in the top 10. Penn State, it wasn't pretty, but they'll take it with the 15-11 win, and I think this is a team to be reckoned with in a new year.
All right, let's look ahead, Dix. So big week coming up, a lot of teams getting in the action for the first time. A very cool game tomorrow. We're recording this before the game. Johns Hopkins Navy on ESPNU, 5 o'clock. I think Quint and Kark have the call. And one of our questions from one of the listeners was a lot of Navy stuff. So they're interested in what the team's going to look like and the job that Coach Soule's doing down there.
You know, it's interesting. Ricky Soule's a different kind of guy. And I have a lot of friends that are involved with the Navy program, and he hasn't been the most popular guy. But when you look at the on-field results, it's tough to argue with what Ricky Soule has done in Annapolis, taking Navy all the way to the quarterfinals last year. And I think this guy is he's won everywhere he's been. You know, he won when he was at Dartmouth. He won when he was at Stony Brook. Now he's winning at Navy and doing a tremendous job. So, and you can't do it without good players. And Navy has some really, really good players. When you talk about Chris Fennell in the defense, I mean, he is a bona fide first-team All-American candidate. Mike Reese at the long stick midfield position is exceptional. Obviously, Casey Reese, they'll miss him out with the knee injury. But Colin Flaunlacker is a handful, a guy who's 6'2", 201. This is a team that is very, very good. Jack Ray, 6'6", at attack. Grayson Terrain, we talked about him last week and his athleticism, and mitigates to a point the loss of Casey Reese. They've got some really, really good players at Navy, and it's going to be a terrific game tomorrow night, 5 o'clock on ESPNU.
Yeah, I'm always looking forward to when the first TV game's on, and especially we're both Blue Jays fans. No sense not acknowledging that. So I'm very excited to see them in action tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously I'm a Blue Jay. I'm always going to be a Blue Jay. I'm a Blue Jay in my heart, but I've become more of a good lacrosse fan.
Sure.
And when
definitely.
Navy and Hopkins get together,
always,
it's always, always good lacrosse. You talk about Hopkins, who's going to start in goal? Is it going to be Gerald Logan, who we just mentioned, mm-hmm. the fifth year senior out of from Michigan, or is it going to be Brock Turnbull, the returner from last season? Joel Tinney has not played. Did not play in preseason scrimmages against Denver, did not play last weekend's High Point. Will he be allowed to suit up tomorrow? NCAA rules violation, stole his sophomore year. Will he be back? Patrick Foley is gone from the defense, announced last week that he will miss the season. Who's going to step in for him to take his spot? So a lot of questions for Hopkins entering what should be a very entertaining season opener to kick off the TV schedule with ESPNU.
So you talked about Navy and what the anticipation for their season coming up. Can they give Loyola a run in the Patriot League? Or is it sort of Loyola and then another tier down with, you know, Army, Bucknell, Colgate maybe?
I think Navy can absolutely give Loyola a run for their money. I mean, this is a Greyhound team that's loaded. Patrick Spencer's back on attack. You know, Romar Dennis and Brian Sherlock in the midfield. We talk about, you know, Jacob Stover, is he back as a starter? Is Grant Lamone the starter? I think it's going to be Stover. So, but Loyola's, you know, they've got a new offensive coordinator, Mark Van Arsdale, coming over from the University of Virginia, taking over for Ryan Moran, sure. Now the head coach at UMBC. So there's some question marks with Loyola in terms of continuity. Not really on the field for players, but, you know, off the field with some new coaches. But Navy's a very, very good lacrosse team. I mean, upset Yale in the first round of the NCAA tournament last year, gave Brown everything they could handle in the quarters before, you know, having their season end. Army is always dangerous, so well coached with Joe Alberisi. We talked earlier about the Bucknell-Delaware game. And, you know, how about Bucknell, a program built on defense, surrendering 6 first-quarter goals, down 6-4 after 1 to Delaware, trailing 11-6 midway through the third quarter, and they were able to go on a run to win on the road by scoring a lot of goals. So I think the Patriot League is very, very it's very balanced this year. It is Loyola's to win or lose, however you want to look at it. I do think they have the most talented team. But there's not a huge drop-off between the Greyhounds and the Midshipmen at this point. I would say then after Loyola Navy, there might be a half a tick step down to the Army Bucknells. And that's no disrespect to those programs. Yeah. I think it's more a tribute to how good Loyola Navy are here in the preseason. It's the preseason versus what might end up being the final standings in May.
So this is a huge week for Navy. I mean, after they play Hopkins on Tuesday, they have to they'll host Maryland at noon on Saturday, which is one of the marquee games of the weekend.
I said at the top of the podcast we weren't going to go into these topics, but you're just going right there, and I love it. And this is for you, the Pit. This is for the Pit.
This is for the Pit.
The Pit follows me, a Johns Hopkins grad, a Johns Hopkins lacrosse player. So mad props to the Pit.
Yeah, he wants to know about the Navy-Maryland game.
Yeah.
And then there's one other game that I just want your thoughts on, the Loyola-Virginia game, which is another, you know, a big game coming up this weekend.
So, okay, let's go Navy-Maryland first. And obviously we'll know much more about the Navy team after Tuesday night's opener against Johns Hopkins. But let's look at this game, Navy-Maryland, in a nutshell. So last season, this game was to be played around this time of year and was postponed because of cold weather. That was that weekend where it was Arctic temperatures, and the wise decisions were made by athletic departments to reschedule games for that particular day. Unfortunately for Navy, that game was rescheduled to the week after they played Army. So they come off, I believe it was an overtime win. I can't remember.
It was a 11-10 overtime win.
So Navy not only physically is, you know, coming off a tough, tough win, and Maryland was coming off a tough game as well. I can't remember exactly who they came off of that weekend. We can look it up real quick. They're in the heart of their Big Ten schedule by that point. So they had come off a win against Rutgers, which was a tough game. That was a game at home in College Park where they had to come back against the Scarlet Knights. But emotionally, Navy just looked flat. I covered that game on Big Ten Network, and Navy just looked like they didn't have anything in the tank. So it might be cold, but it's very advantageous for Navy to play Maryland this time of year. The thing about Navy, and it used to be more poignant before a lot of physical training regimens came into the off season for other teams. Navy always starts out fairly well because they're so in shape. They don't have an opportunity to, you know, hang out and, you know, eat too many carbs and, you know, lay around or anything like that. Not that, I mean, you see the lacrosse student athlete these days is 24/7, 12 months a year, 365 days a year, working their butts off. But this is a good opportunity for Navy. They always play. Typically play Maryland tough. John Tillman has had the midshipman's number since he's taken over in College Park. There have been a couple of lopsided games, including last year, where Navy, again, just physically and emotionally just seems spent. So this is going to be a very, very good lacrosse game between two very, very talented teams. Maryland, they open up their season this weekend against... Nope, their season opener is Navy. I apologize. Yeah. I thought they were playing. They played High Point last year, season opener. That game's a little bit later in the season, so they'll be fresh. And they're going to be hungry to get after a different color jersey in a game situation, whereas Navy will have already had that Hopkins game under their belt. Loyola Virginia, I think the first thing that jumps off the page, Mark Van Arsdale faces his former.
Yeah, a lot of storylines here, yeah.
A lot of storylines there. I mean, who can forget the game a couple years ago in Charlottesville, the buzzer beater? That ultimately led to the rule change in NCAA lacrosse. So it used to be when the clock hit triple zeros, the ball had to be
across the line,
the goal line. The NCAA committee looked at that play in particular, in addition to others, but that play in particular spurred a rule change similar to college basketball, meaning if the ball is released before the clock hits triple zero and then goes into the goal, it's a good goal. So I think it's a very good rule change.
It makes sense.
It really
and it's probably easier to enforce.
It is. The only tricky part of it is if it's shot and is released before the clock hits triple zeros but hits an offensive player and goes in the goal, it's no goal. But if it hits a defensive player and goes in the goal, it's a goal. So that can be a little tricky. But fortunately, officials haven't had to deal with that situation that often throughout the course of that rule change. But, I mean, you're looking at a Virginia team again. I see this team being much improved. Lars Tiffany's putting his stamp on that program. You know, he cut six or seven guys in the fall. He just dismissed another player
right.
the last couple weeks, so he's not playing around. You're going to play Lars Tiffany lacrosse, and you're going to live by Lars Tiffany rules or you're not going to be around. But that's a team, you know, Ryan Conrad looks like he's firing on all cylinders. You've got Zed Williams poised to have a tremendous senior season. He's bumped down. He's playing a little bit more attack, at least theoretically. He may be playing some more attack. Defensively, you know, that's going to be the challenge for Virginia, you know, trying to prevent a lot of goals. Matt Barrett, their starting goaltender, is not enrolled at the University of Virginia, so a new goaltender, Will Raley, is going to get the nod there. So that has a potential to be a 13-12, 14-13 kind of game. A lot of offensive firepower on both sides of the field. I give the defensive advantage to Loyola in that matchup.
Excellent, Dix. All right, we'll wrap up here. I want to start a new segment. We'll call it 3-on-3 for now. We'll just attack some question, pop culture type of thing. My question today, I want your top three best Super Bowl party foods.
Super Bowl party foods.
I can give you mine. I'll give you a second to think about it.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I love anything with, like, buffalo chicken. So I make a mean buffalo chicken dip.
Really?
Eat it with Fritos. Absolutely delicious, and it's filling. But last night I was at a place, and this someone had made buffalo chicken meatballs, and they were unbelievable. So think of it like a mini crab cake is what they look like. They were outstanding. And then that's my second one. My new favorite is these buffalo chicken meatballs. And then I'll go with an old standby, chili. Love some chili. Had a bowl of chili last night, too.
Yeah.
Put a little cheese on there.
Yeah.
Guy made it in the crock pot. It was outstanding. So what are your three favorite Super Bowl football type of foods to nosh on during the game?
Well, first of all, I'm going to call foul on you. You said buffalo chicken anything, and you went 1-2 with the buffalo chicken. Buffalo chicken anything and buffalo chicken meatballs. So you really only gave me two things. That's all encompassing.
There were two distinctly different things. If you'd seen them,
I mean,
a buffalo chicken dip is it's very different.
Okay, I'll give you that. I had a buffalo chicken meatball Saturday night. My wife and I were out at a wine tasting, and one of the vendors had buffalo chicken meatballs. So
what kind of wine did they serve with it?
I mean, just
like
all
a white
different
or
kinds.
Like a
all
like
different
a
kinds.
Okay.
So it's basically an event where all different vendors come. And sell
did they try to pair the buffalo chicken meatball with a particular wine is what I'm interested
in. I'm not that sophisticated. I'm a red guy. I like Cab. I like Malbec. Pinot Noir, okay.
Pinot Noir is the best.
Okay. Well, it's light. So you like the lighter of the reds. I like more of a full-bodied. You know.
Hey, everything has its place
exactly.
and time.
But first of all, I don't like to go to Super Bowl parties anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I had fun. It was a neighborhood one. It was a lot of fun. Plus, I let my little kids run around with the other kids that they're friends with, which was nice. But it's impossible to watch the game and focus on it.
Impossible to watch the game, but I hear you. So my boys are 14 and 12. Yeah. So they're a little older than your kids. So they're into the game, and they just want to watch it. And my wife does a great job of making a nice spread. Last night we had meatball sliders, spinach
delicious.
And artichoke dip.
Okay, not my
favorite. And she made this appetizer with stone crackers. And some guacamole with spicy shrimp on top. It was good.
Yeah.
It was very, very good. So my three, got to go with buffalo. I'm a buffalo wing guy. I love buffalo wings. You can't go wrong.
The only problem with wings, it's tough to eat at a party, though, if you're walking around. And
well,
you
that's
got
why
a
you don't
plate.
Go to a party. That's why you stay home. That's why you stay home and you just gorge and, you know, in front of the television. You don't have to worry about anything.
I can picture you wearing your Tom Brady jersey.
Tom Brady jersey. All right. Wait a second. That's way out of bounds. Way out of bounds right there.
With your feet up and you're like Zubaz, Patriots pants.
With the plate on my stomach. Like not even on a table, just like on my stomach and just taking the bones and throwing it to the dog, right? So buffalo wings. I love dips.
Yeah.
So the spinach artichoke dip was amazing that my wife made. I'm a big fan of like a 7-layer dip.
Oh, those are
I
good.
Mean, your buffalo chicken dip.
Yeah.
So dips, you gotta have you have to have a dip of some sort. I'm allergic to shellfish, so I can't do crab dip, which is kind of a bummer.
So how did you do the shrimp?
I can do shrimp. Shrimp is a. I'm no marine biologist, but.
He's George Costanza here.
I am no George Costanza, but apparently shrimp is a crustacean, and there's a different. I don't know. It has to do with the iodine concentration or something. But My wife does get upset with me. She doesn't think I should be eating any of it.
Gotcha.
But, you know.
But she still makes it for you.
Still makes it.
Throws it out there.
Well, you know, we got the kids too.
Rest the bowl on your belly.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, so.
With a big stain. So we've got.
Dips.
We got buffalo wings, dip. I got to go with your chili call. I mean, a good chili with, you know, with some shredded cheese melted on top, you know, a little dollop of sour cream maybe, throw some jalapeno in there. Mm-hmm. I got to go.
Now, do you put it over, like, I like it over macaroni.
No, never. No. Yeah,
I like it over macaroni. It's a little more filling. I grew up in a family with six kids. My mom would put, you know, anything to carb us up and make it a little more filling.
Yeah, I was out at Ohio State, actually, a couple weeks ago, and chili mac or something like that? Like that, you go to a restaurant and they serve... Maybe not over macaroni.
Did you get Cincinnati chili? This is very different.
Well, maybe, yeah, okay. So
it's like a spicier kind of thing. You can put Cincinnati chili on like hot dogs and pasta. Yeah, they did that.
But the chili was wasn't as full bodied as I like thick chili. I don't like runny chili. And it wasn't as like full bodied or spicy as what I would make at home or my wife would make at home. So I wasn't a big fan. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not a big fan. Cornbread, like some cornbread with it.
It's real good.
Or nachos, like nacho chips, you know, like...
Fritos or Tostitos type of things?
Tostitos.
Corn chips.
Tostitos or those organic blue chips. They're like bluish.
Fancy. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Hey, man, we go to Trader Joe's every now and again.
Yeah, those are good. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Also, the guacamole that you can get at Trader Joe's.
It is good. I think that's the guac that my wife made the spicy shrimp cracker appetizers with. And the other thing is, we didn't get one this year. We get one every, if we think about it, the Carvel football cake.
Oh.
The Carvel football cake is key.
Oh.
Those chocolate crunchies on the outside.
I love
as opposed
ice
to being
cream
on
cake.
The inside.
I would prefer for a I'm not a big cake guy. I'm a pie guy. I'd rather have a birthday pie. I mean, pies are just so much better. But yeah, an ice cream cake, that's the way to go.
And have you ever had the Carvel football cake?
No, I can picture it though.
So like when you do a Carvel cake, when you cut it, the you know, where your icing would be on a regular cake, that's where the chocolate crunchies are.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
So the crunchies are on the outside of the football cake to give it that football. Oh man.
So it looks like football.
It's so good.
Oh man.
So good.
That's a family of four, though. That's pretty big. You gotta get through that thing.
Well, let me tell you.
Because ice cream cakes are not good like the next day. They kind of melt a little bit, especially at a party because it's sitting out. And
well, you throw it in the freezer.
It kind of melts a little bit.
Again, that's why you don't go to a party. You sit at home and watch the game. But, back when the kids were younger, that football cake used to hang around for a while.
Yeah.
I tell you, I mean, with a 14- and 12-year-old boy, it's like half the cake. They're like, you know, like, oh, get a big enough piece, you know. So leftovers are not a problem with the Carvel ice cream cake or anything else for that matter.
Awesome. All right, everybody, that's a wrap for this week. Enjoy the games. If you want to send us a question or a suggestion, you can get at Dixon Lacrosse on Twitter, and I'm @D_Fly. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Dixon.